Okay, everyone, this week's Parsha, upcoming Parsha, is Parsha Chayei Sarah. And the title is Tom Brady and Giselle Bundchen versus Avram and Sarah. Where am I going with this? Okay, so as you may have, if you've been happened to be in a supermarket and you took a look at the reading section, maybe a People magazine, perhaps you may have a big thing is welcome, Stacy. A big title has been that Tom Brady and Giselle Bundchen got divorced. So let's go to the videotape, make sure everybody's up on all the information, and we'll take it from there. So let us begin. I'll do a little share screen. Here we go. Okay.
Bundchen and Tom Brady have called it quits.
She's my best friend, so I think you just, we spend as much time as we can together. And, it's a busy life we have. Don't let that retirement fool you with her. She works more than any retired person I know.
On Friday, the two announced the news on Instagram, Giselle writing that they have amicably finalized their divorce. Quote, "The decision to end a marriage is never easy, but we have grown apart. And while it is, of course, difficult to go through something like this, I feel blessed for the time we had together and only wish the best for Tom always." The two tied the knot in 2009 and are parents to 12-year-old Benjamin and 9-year-old Vivian. Tom is also dad to 15-year-old Jack from his previous relationship with Bridget Moynihan.
I don't get all the opportunities during the season to spend with the children and with my wife, so that's why the off-season's such a nice time for me.
Giselle writes that they will continue co-parenting to give them the love, care, and attention they greatly deserve.
They're just special moments with your family, and it's a great part of my life, and I take advantage of it when I can.
Meanwhile, Tom shared a similar sentiment, writing that their children will continue to be the center of their world. A source tells ET Giselle and Tom worked on the terms of their settlement with a mediator. It has all been worked out, and they agreed to joint custody of their children. And Tom writes that the decision to end their marriage has been painful and difficult. Quote, "We wish only the best for each other as we pursue whatever new chapters in our lives that are yet to be written." News of their split comes after Giselle was spotted without her wedding ring and was noticeably absent from Tom's games. A source previously told ET that the two haven't been in a good place. The source added that Giselle feels like Tom has chosen his career over his family and she is tired of it. Quote, "She also has her own dreams and aspirations and doesn't want to have to keep putting her goals on hold.
I feel like I'm so driven to succeed in football, and that's taken me away from other important priorities, which are my kids, my wife, and she's really held it down for our family.
Yeah.
And I'm just super grateful that, she really committed so much of her time the last, 14 years to make sure everything was so stable at home so I could go live my dream."
Of course, this all comes after Tom's decision to unretire from the NFL back in March. A source previously told ET that Giselle had been telling Tom for a while that he needed to spend more time with the family. And after he retired, she thought she was getting what she asked for. Quote, "Once Tom decided to go back to the NFL, she was devastated. Giselle is very hurt." Meanwhile, a source told ET earlier this month, Tom was holding out hope that they could work things out. Quote, "He loves his family, but also wants to continue his career. He feels like he is in a tough spot."
All right. Okay. So, all right, let's get to some questions. Okay. So, obviously, whenever you're talking about a marriage, even if you're friends with the people, it's hard to know what's happening within a marriage. Okay, that's in general. Then when you talk about a public marriage, Tom Brady, America's, most successful quarterback, first for the New England Patriots, now for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And Giselle Bundchen, who has been on, according to Wikipedia, 1,200 magazine covers. So she's one of the wealthiest models and most successful models. So here's a couple questions. So everything on we're using them as a obviously as a perspective to appreciate. We're going to utilize that to appreciate the partial a little bit. That's obviously our objective here. So everything we're going to say is going to be a measure of speculation. But okay, but what we can perceive and the way that they are talking about each other, is Tom Brady a good father? What we're led to believe? What would you guys say?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, to the extent that I know, you know what I mean?
Right. I mean, there's no complaint about his. There's no complaint about him as a father per se, other than there seems to be one chief lingering, openly they both talk about it. What's the principal complaint?
He puts work over family.
Well, what does that really mean? Let's drill down that specifically.
It's getting 90% of his attention.
Well, is he the only person that works? I mean, most dads go out and work. You have to appreciate Tom Brady as an athlete to understand this a little deeper. Shane, you have an insight here.
I was going to say that he's probably not at home or not home as much as the dad who works a 9-to-5 desk job, because he's got practice probably 5-6 days out of the week. And that's during the off season. During the season, he's got practice probably also 4 or 5 days of the week. And that's if the games are home games, then he can go home after practice and after the game. But if they're traveling or if they're on the road, then who knows when he's home, not home, if Giselle may be able to go with him or if they're stuck or if they stay home. And then if he has back-to-back weeks at away games, is he home in between or is he on the road the whole time?
So the way that he described it in another interview, I couldn't share all the information, but basically from August through January, if he goes into the postseason, he does not do work. He does not attend birthdays. He doesn't attend funerals. This guy, the cost, the level of dedication that he has had to football and being the top of the game that he has is basically 24/7. So he is a shadow of a parent from August to January. And the way that he was working this 13-year relationship was that basically – from January through July, he was far more present. He was, he didn't do anything other than he was home. Obviously, he has to work out. He has to maintain shape. As Shane says, there's conditioning he has to still go. A client points out, well, said he also has a fashion line and he has his health and nutrition stuff. Right. He's also a businessman in addition to that. So he's a good father, but for the last, 13, 14 years of this thing, sort of gone half the year, more akin to like a soldier who goes on, or a sailor who goes on a long tour and is away is a more accurate kind of depiction. Was he faithful? Any claims of infidelity?
No.
No claims of infidelity that we know. Again, we don't know. So here's the amazing thing. We're talking about two superstars, two international superstars. How were they able to keep it together for 13 years? Let's first talk about the positive. How were they able to accomplish that? Anybody have an insight? I think it came a little bit through the video a little bit.
They say they're best friends. I still believe that.
Well, so they're best friends, but then obviously you don't get your divorce from your best friend if you're female.
Saying, I guess there's different types of, right, we have in this week's parasha, next week's parasha, 2 weeks' parasha, Ahavaha, right? How he loved her, right? Take her into the tent, and he loved her after, or whatever types of love we're talking about. But
we are going to get into the topic of love. Absolutely, that is our focus tonight. But the question we have to ask is like, but what was a fundamental thing that came through the video? What was successful about their relationship between Tom Brady and Giselle?
They were probably each other's cheerleaders, also.
Their cheerleaders, and basically there was a very clear understanding, which is that she basically put largely her personal.
Her side. She put her whole career and stardom on the side for his, and now that he has it all, she expected to be able to do her thing and have him at home again.
Right, and so the deceit to be was like, number one, you know, there was a sort of a, there were basically, they had a deal going on. Seems that they had a deal, which is, I will be home for the kids. I'll raise the kids. I'll put my own, you know, my own career number two. And I'm going to support you and be your cheerleader, as Chaim pointed out very nicely, for your success as, you know, America's quarterback. And things were going well. And then what pivotal moment happened in their relationship? That what changed everything? Yeah, I know a little football about this. There's a big event that changed it.
Is not just what she said there, that he went back into out of retirement, back in the game?
How long was Tom Brady retired from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? Anybody know this is an advanced
football? It was like months. Yeah, weeks. Was it very long?
40 days. He was retired for 40 days. Now, so let's before he changed his mind. Why do you think was Giselle so happy that Tom Brady retired from football? What would you imagine she was saying in the house in the upcoming aspect of in celebrating his retirement? What do you think she was saying?
I would just thank God he's home.
Eight times, and then Shayna.
He's gonna be home. He's gonna be present with the kids. We can spend time with him. He's not gonna disappear for half the year.
Yeah. And secondarily, I don't have to be putting my dreams in my career, which was enormous, on hold for him. Now we could hand off. We could have a nice equal, switcheroo. So he'll be present, and I can also pursue more fully my interests as well. That in a certain sense seems to be the deal. And things were going well. And then 4 days later, what did he basically, what basically happened? And also, she's also very concerned, and she said it vocally, this is all reported in the press, she was also nervous as a guy who's over 40 to play football, that he might get hurt. I mean, these people, you've got to see a football player. These athletes are powerful, strong, huge individuals who have one objective: to sack the quarterback in a, you know, in a very painful manner. Okay. So that's kind of good when you're like 27 and you're in good condition. But if you're like 42, you started to push the 40s. What is she? She was also nervous about that. You know, he might have a very significant injury she's not going to get the same Tom Brady back after the game that she had sent before the game, which is a real concern. Anyways. So why do you think she was so upset has returned to the game at this point when she accepted it for so long? In other words, she had been the cheerleader for 13 years. Now, his love of the sport and his desire to keep on going, and, you know, even said, maybe I can be a quarterback till age 50. That's what he said, till age 50. Why did she say, and I'm out. What happened there? Yeah, Shayna.
It's coming across as a very selfish decision by Tom Brady to come out of retirement after having, we could say, like discussions with his wife, discussions with his family about maybe it's her turn to go back to work now after supporting him and letting him do his dream job. 40 is young in the grand scheme of things, but it's not young in professional sports, and especially not young when it's such a physical sport like football, where even we're seeing in like 30-year-olds who I think have been passing away because of all the concussion injuries and multiple concussion injuries from the sport.
Yes. Right. So you're saying that you think that basically there was a fundamental selfishness on his part, that here he is, he's a 45-year-old guy playing football, which, you know, like, how long did Tom Brady play football for?
I mean, as long as he wants to, really.
How long did he?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Like, when did he start? I don't know. Yeah. It's like his 20th season, 22nd season.
23 seasons. 23 seasons in the NFL, which is nearly, I think, a record.
He's got all the records: passing, touchdowns, Super Bowls.
Right, 23 seasons. That's like ridiculous.
If so, you named the quarterback record.
Right, I mean 20 seasons with of course the New England Patriots, and three seasons with Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So all right, so that's the thing. So let's get to our first source that we're going to look to today to appreciate what's going on, to allow us to understand the parsha, I believe, in a deeper manner. Okay, so here we go. All right, Shana. Vakasha. Can you see the sheet?
Yes, we're good. I see it.
Okay, good. So let's start with the first pasuk that we're going to take. This is going back to a pasuk that we've done. This is a classic pasuk, critical. Yeah.
And you want the Hebrew or the English?
Yeah, I'll do Hebrew than English. Good pasuk to read in Hebrew.
Vayomer Hashem Elokim lo tov eyot ha'adam levado e'esei lo ezer kenegdo. Hashem said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make him an Ezer Kenegdo.
Yes. Okay. So the famous Rashi, we've done this before. Read Rashi.
A helper for him. Keneged, literally opposite, opposed to him. If he is worthy, she shall be a help to him. If he is unworthy, she shall be opposed to him to fight him.
All right. This is all Gemara from Yevamos. Okay. So what does a man have to do to be worthy? What does a man have to be worthy for his wife to help him?
I would say at a starting point that he has to be honest, loyal, has to help around the home, have to have a steady job with a good base income, like be a good partner.
Right, so be a good partner, but being a good partner. So you're saying what that really talks about all the things that the person brings to the relationship as being a honorable, trusted friend who is ensuring that the resources are there collectively to build the home together. Okay, so conversely, what makes a man unworthy?
The opposite of that, I would say, one who doesn't do his part to have a functional relationship with his partner.
Doesn't do his part to have a functional relationship. I don't know if it's just the money, because let's say a guy lost his job. I don't think she would definitely fight him, because it may not be, you know, people have ups and downs, including financial situations.
It's not just the money, but it's...
It seems to be more issues of character than issues of circumstance. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in other words, so if a person is... I think the question number six will get the issue a little more deeply. According to the understanding of the Midrash, was Tom Brady worthy or unworthy? What do you say? Was he worthy or unworthy? He certainly was. Was a good provider for the family, right? He
was worthy when he was there, when he was present.
Okay, so, all right, but apparently, because it says if he's unworthy, she will oppose him to fight him. Clearly, she opposed him to fight him because they are currently divorced. No greater fight than actually, I need to get out of this relationship and let's get a mediator, which will save them a ton of money. Let's end this. So obviously there was an unworthiness. What was the unworthiness? Or the perceived unworthiness. I'm not judging between each side of the couple. What was the perceived unworthiness of this relation within this relationship? And I think we mentioned it before.
He put his career over the family?
Yeah. He was, in other words, he would be, as we said before, in other words, there was a credit home, and he already had 22 years in the NFL hitting all the records. And basically, there seemed to be an understanding like, we need you home. Our kids need to have a greater, quote unquote, FaceTime with you. And then, because he just wants to pursue his ambition of being the, I don't know, the longest possible quarterback in the NFL, or records, whatever his ambition is, you know, he's just enjoying the love of the sport, but at the expense of what at least Giselle claimed was necessary for the relationship. So a home, a successful home has a mission of where the home, where the values of the success of the home, the children, the values and those principles is the highest principle, and the person's ambitions are instrumental to that. Here, he took his ambition and that became more important than everything else. Well, that of course caused his house of cards to fall apart, and therefore he went to go pursue he was, as Shane said earlier, relayed to the household as basically rest of the household as being using them, or you're there when I need you, and you're there is to you, Giselle, have to remain, take care of the kids while I get to enjoy the greatness of my never-ending football career, you know. And too bad. And she said, I don't think so. And she put us, you know, and therefore, you know, that in order, if you come to a relationship, we've discussed this many times, where each person is trying to extract their particular issue, their particular interest, attention, use the other party. This is going to be it's not an Acer Connect relationship, and the thing's going to collapse. Even though they had all the money in the world. Also, she's very wealthy. Her financial net is in the tens of millions of dollars. He's in the financial, you know, and they have other businesses and they own properties. All the money in the world made no difference. Did not help. Okay. Now let's bring the stars of our parsha. Let's take a look at the beginning part of, all right. So, Shane, you're on a roll. Read some more psukim here.
Sarah had lived to be 127 years old. These were the years of Sarah's life. Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, also known as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her.
Okay. So first of all, many people who we have been, I've been with you to Hebron. We went to Mars and Machpelah. This is where Sarah is buried. We actually made a visit there. Those who were on the fellowship trip. And something very interesting is that Avram comes to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her. But here's the question. What occurs first, crying or eulogizing?
Eulogizing.
When somebody dies. Well, I'm sorry, let me be more accurate. When you get the bad news that somebody passed away, what happens first, crying or eulogizing?
Crying.
Crying, you have this immediate reaction to the loss. Okay. Now, he comes there to eulogize Sarah and then to weep for her. Now, so what's the purpose? Let's go through it. What's the purpose? What does crying do? And what does eulogizing do? They have two different roles. Who can share with that? Stacy, you want to add anything here? What is the function of crying when somebody passes away?
Wait, am I here?
Yeah, you're here.
Hear me?
Yeah, we hear loud and clear.
Okay. When someone cries, when someone passes away, well, you're sad. It's your way of showing that you've lost someone that you care about and that you miss their presence and pain also. And yeah.
All true. So what is the, how does crying help? So there's one part of the crying is shows the magnitude of the loss and shows that the person is in pain, that the fact they're no longer there. And it shows the great, you know, the sense of that, you know, yeah, the enormity of the loss, but also has another function. What does it do? What is it also helping the person? There's a benefit to crying.
It's a relief.
Exactly. the crime. Yeah, Eitan, you want to express it a little more? You want to unpack that a little more?
When people undergo all this, there's just so much pressure and tension and mixed emotions and confusion, and it's hard to keep it all straight. It's extremely disorienting. It takes a big toll on the body, and crying helps to release that tension and kind of break a person out of that shock, and allow them to, you know, continue with whatever they have to do.
Eitan, outstanding answer. Thank you. In other words, crying is cathartic. It's a release. There's a when a person has the devastating trauma, it's a trauma, really. When somebody passed away, a loved one, it's a traumatic experience. So one way, and there's a tremendous, as Eitan said, tremendous pressure eternally of all tremendous emotions. And one way to deal with these tremendous emotions, the release, is the crying. That's why you'll see very thing when a person's also very, very happy. Let's say a parent sees their daughter. I just saw today Stacey and Evan's 4-minute video on Facebook. So I did happen to see some of the parents shedding a little tears. Now, why were they crying? Why is crying also a response at a wedding? You'll see a lot of tears at a wedding. Why is that? You see, or it's weird. You see tears at a funeral and you see tears at a wedding. But there's a common denominator. What's the common denominator? No jokes about weddings, no marriage.
Overcome with emotion.
And therefore, so what does the crying come to do?
Pure emotional preparation.
Say it again.
It's like a pure emotion. No, it's just an emotional release. It's total spontaneous. It is what it is. No preparation.
Correct. So both of them, when you have a buildup of very intense emotions, either sadness and pain for a funeral, there's crying. And when there's tremendous joy and happiness at a wedding, it's overwhelming. It will come out in tears, crying. It's a release of the tension of the joy. So you can actually, that's what we say, tears of joy and tears of sadness. Okay. So that's what the crying is. Now, so here's the question. The key question of the night, we're going to weave it in. Why did Avram change the order? It says that he apparently was not in town. He hears about the news. He may have cried initially. He doesn't say. But when he came to Hebron, he came to eulogize Sarah and to weep over her. So he clearly did the cry. He did the eulogy. Okay, we didn't say. Oh, hold on. I need to explain. Back up before I get the eulogy. What is a eulogy? What is a eulogy? I know it's a speech that people give at a funeral, but what is the goal or objective or character of a eulogy speech at a funeral? Anybody know? Anybody been to a funeral before?
To uplift everybody a little bit, to share some good memories of the person, to commemorate him, and put some Gamza Tova into the situation.
All right, so part of it will be sharing stories, vignettes, what makes a good eulogy? What makes a good eulogy?
Something that's personal.
Okay, it's got to be personal, number one, and therefore you can have good personal stories, too. What personal stories are the best one to share at a funeral? The fact that they one time took you out for ice cream, is that a good story to share at a funeral? That their favorite dessert is cherry cheesecake, is that a good? It's a memory. It's personal. Would you say that's a good thing to share at a eulogy?
It could be.
How they affected you.
So their impact. Now we're start going to the key thing is really their really what you want to hone in is what were their key virtues? What were their good qualities? What was the element of their character that is was so impactful for the family, and who is what there really is their legacy. So a good eulogy is, first of all, as Evan said, is personal and has good sharing of stories, but it points to what was good about the person and what tremendous thing, what are we losing now that they're not here? You know what I'm saying? That is the key thing. What did that person stand for? A nice metaphor you can use that I've heard many times is that every person is, in a sense, a Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll. And they have a story, and they have certain good deeds and values and virtues. Everybody has something good about them, okay? And if you're there to read sort of the highlights of from the story of their life, what was the highlight? What were some of the highlights of the person's character? That's so important that you, and as sharing a eulogy, want to make sure that the family remembers. What were some of the most memorable qualities of the person? Let's say they were very kind, very giving, very generous. You'll share those stories. Let's say they're very wise and they gave great instruction. You'll give those stories. Let's say they, they did tremendous things for the community. You'll share those stories. You know what I'm saying? You're going to find those elements. Okay. So why, with that background, why did Avram come into Hebron in front of the entire audience of the people who lived there, which was the tribe of Chet, that's the Hittite people there. Why did he first eulogize? And then he went, after the eulogy, went in and cried. Why was the crying sequenced out of a great sense of discipline? Why did he do the eulogy first and the crying second? All right, Shane, what do you say?
I think Abraham and Sarah were very public figures, that they were teachers, they were leaders. And as such, Abraham, I guess through his eulogy of Sarah, gave comfort to the people. And once he was then able to do that, he was then able to express his own emotions privately for her.
Excellent. In other words, Sarah had two identities. Sarah was his beloved wife for 100 years. Okay. Long marriage. And two, she was the leader of the what they call the Beit Abraham, the house of Abraham. And she, according to the Midrash, she led the women. And Avram could not be Avram without his Azer Kenegdo, his true life partner, Sarah. So therefore, the most important thing, so what was he prioritizing? His personal relationship or her public identity? Well, Shane just said, he focused upon, we have to appreciate the magnitude of our loss here. What was Sarah all about? And she was a private person also. She was, the Talmud learns the idea of tzniut. She was not a grab the mic, step in the spotlight person, but from her vantage point, she was very impactful because, according to the Midrash, she educated a whole generation of women. Okay? He talks of, we don't have the text, sadly, of the Midrash, of what he said, but no doubt he recounted the great qualities that she had, being very virtuous, very smart, her great ability to teach people on different levels. I mean, she was an impact player. And then he's able to, and because of that recounting of her greatness, he would then reflect on the loss of the people, which he would obviously produce crying. The goal of a good eulogy is that it makes people cry. Because people can feel on a visceral level the loss. A good eulogy gets people crying. And then the crying is basically the personal loss. So first he focused on the public dimension, which is through the eulogy, and then is the private loss. Now, the Gemara states that like Giselle, Sarah was one of the most beautiful women in the world had ever seen. The Talmud recounts that she's one of the beautiful, most beautiful women in the entire world. Based on the way the Torah chooses to present her beauty, you know, like in the earlier of Lech Lecha, it says, "Now I know that you are a beautiful woman," said Avram on the way down to Egypt. Do you think her beauty was mentioned in the eulogy? Do you think Avram talked about that Sarah was a beautiful woman? What do you think, Scott? Do you think that was part of his speech, that him talking about her amazing physical beauty?
No, I don't think he focused on that or would focus on that.
Right. Even if she was the most beautiful person. I mean, in other words, in a certain sense, like Giselle, objectively, I mean, the fact that if assuming that a international model being on 1,200 magazine covers is a measure of beauty, which I think we can say it safely it is, Sarah was also a very beautiful woman. But what does the Torah focus upon? From Parshas Lecha and Vayera, what things did the Torah talk about that Sarah did? What does the Torah focus upon her contribution to the Abrahamic movement? What things does she what highlights? If you guys looked at the Parsha, what does the Torah talk about?
I believe she helped him prepare food for their guests and washed, and I think she helped them wash their feet or brought the water to wash their feet as well.
So number one, she's an equal partner in his campaign of bringing in the wayfarers, bringing in people, you know, haknasat orchim. But also, when she felt that he was acting improperly when they had a problem with Ishmael or dealing with Hagar, she makes her opinion. She says something which was very difficult for him to accept, and then Hashem had to say to Avram, listen to the voice of Sarah, because she's right. You know what I'm saying? So she was a tremendous advisor to him. And let's not forget the tremendous sacrifice. Did God command Sarah to go to Ur Kasdim to Canaan? No. But Sarah was a true partner in both good times and bad. And then they show up and they go down to Egypt. What happens to her? Well, she gets taken, abducted. She goes with the plan. Hey, I'm Abraham's sister. Oh, and then Paro took her. And then God intervenes and gets her rescued. And then later on, they go to Gerar, another famine. And, oh, I'm Abraham's sister. Boom, Avimelech the king takes her also. So she had to endure a lot of, she had to sacrifice a great deal to have, to be with Avram and to support Avram. And Midrash says to teach all the people that were part of Avram's community. That's what he no doubt talked about. She's a great, what we call in America, a great thinker, a great thought leader, a person who is committed to building the entire Abrahamic enterprise, which of course is, they are the mother and father of Judaism. And by extension, the other two monotheistic religions, the Islam and Christianity, also view them as being their parents as well. So tremendous impact in the world. The fact that she was beautiful actually allowed her to be helpful, that people wanted to, you know, who likes beautiful women in addition to men? Women. If a woman's beautiful and she's put together, you're more likely to take her, you're more likely to value what she has to say because she reflects a perfection. But she was also very sneeze. So she had this sort of interesting balance over here. So she was a great person. Okay, now let's fast forward to the end of the Parsha. We have, of course, the Avram buries Sarah. Avram dispatches his servant, which the Midrash says is Eliezer, to find a wife for Yitzchak. All right, we get to the end of the story. Eitan, can you read the Pasuk 66, Samach Vav and Samach Zayin, or the in the English at least? Eitan.
Sorry, just a moment. Don't want to wake up a sleeping child.
Yeah, don't do that. Bad idea if you do. Yeah.
Okay. 66 and 67?
That's correct.
Okay. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. And Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted for his mother.
Okay. So very interesting pasuk. So the servant comes back, tells Avram the whole story, the story about the well, and Rebekah, Rivka, not only, he said, could I have some water? And she said, not only will I give you water, but I'll also give water to all your camels, the famous story. And then the whole episode, him talking to Betuel, her father, and love on her brother. And ultimately, they agreed to come back. And now, basically, talking about blind dating, this is about as blind dating as you can get. Not only is it blind dating, it's like a blind marriage. You know, Yitzchak is introduced to his bride. Okay? So, all right, we're going to talk about that as well. But now, this is an incredible Rashi. Let's take a look at this Rashi. Shana Bavakashel, let's read this Rashi out.
To the tent of Sarah, his mother. He brought her to the tent, and behold, she was Sarah, his mother, i.e., she became the likeness of Sarah, his mother. For as long as Sarah was alive, a candle burned from one Shabbat Eve to the next. A blessing was found in the dough, and a cloud was attached to the tent. When she died, these things ceased. And when Rebecca arrived, they resumed.
Beautiful. Okay, so a couple questions. Why did Yitzchak bring her into Sarah's tent? Why do we need to know that? The Torah doesn't give us personal biographical details about the patriarchs. Why is Yitzchak bringing her specifically into his mother's tent? I mean, Sarah's dead. What's going on with that? What do you guys say? What is significant about him bringing her into Sarah's tent? I mean, that's the key point. That's a very important point of understanding the relationship. Or he brings her to the tent.
You mean she's passed away at this point? His mother.
Many years already. At least 3-4 years. Yeah.
I mean, is he trying to say, like, my mom was, like, so important in my life, I just want you to know a little bit about her?
But it's interesting, the Rashi seems to be saying, when he brought her to tent, and behold, she was Sarah. Now, Rivka, in a certain sense, became, quote-unquote, like Sarah. Then he has the Midrash gives three miracles. When Sarah was around, she'd light Shabbos candles before Shabbos, and they'd last all 7 days till next Shabbos. And then she'd light them a new set. And then when she was alive, there was a blessing found in the dough. I guess it was, it was extra yummy or extra good, whatever it was. And there was attached a cloud to the tent, which we're going to talk about those three things. So when they died, these three quote unquote little miracles ended. And when Rivka arrives, they resume. What really is the Midrash using these various images really trying to say? What was Yitzchak trying to accomplish, and what exactly happened here? It's a very dramatic point. Rashi trying to tell us something.
Rivka is continuing Sarah's work. What Sarah started as the mother of the Jews, Rivka's continuing.
Yes. Not only continue, but the biggest thing is that who can step into these shoes? In other words, Sarah was not just a woman. She is she's a rock star. She's an amazing woman. So what Rivka, shows up, and she goes into her tent, which means that she's sort of taking on the role, as Shana so eloquently said, as sort of a filling the office or the role of Sarah. And these three miracles, what are Shabbos candles represent? It's Shabbat. It provides peace in the home. That's the purpose of lighting. The place is lit up for Shabbat. So the idea of, that's one mitzvah that women talk about. Notice that. It talks about, it really mirrors the Mishnah we say on B'mei Madlikin. There are three mitzvot that women are uniquely obligated in, which is Ner Shabbat, the Shabbos candle, the mitzvah of Hafrashat Challah, separating challah, okay? And third is the laws of Nida, the laws of family purity, which represent by a cloud, like the Mishkan, over the tent. So apparently what the Midrash is pointing to is that she was able to inhabit the values and the virtues of his mother. So question 13, why did the love occur after Rivka was in Sarah's tent? When, what about before that? This, and Isaac brought her into Sarah, the mother of Sarah's tent, and he took Rivka and she became his wife, and he loved her. This is not describing it happened in one moment, one day. And this could be over many years. Why did Yitzchak love emerge after she's quote unquote in her tent? What's the nature of this unique, the kind of love that the pasuk is talking about?
He grew to appreciate her. Specifically, since the pasuk is focusing on these spiritual things, he grew to really appreciate her soul and her values, and that they were basically on the same mission.
Exactly. To put it in succinct words, she became his soulmate. And then it happened day one. It happened when she started to appreciate the depth and greatness of her. You know what I'm saying? So in this sense, a real love, there are two kinds of love. One love is before marriage, where you are attracted to the other person and you sense the greatness of the person. Then there's a thing called, you know, then there's the wedding, which is great. And then there's a thing called, wedding easy, marriage hard. Just ask Tom and Giselle. So the hard work of is part of, but when things go well, there's an appreciation that there's a love of each other person. There's an appreciation of how each person is an Azer Kenegdo. So the love that Yitzchak had, the Torah records, is that how awesome she was because in her own way, she is very Sarah-esque. Which gets into another weird thing is that Yitzchak was comforted after his mother. Now, what is he? Is this a guy who has a grieving problem? What does he mean that he was comforted after his mother? How is Rivka comfort? She can't bring Sarah back. And why did Yitzchak love? You know, why was it he loved her and then he was comforted? What is significant about those two feelings or the two perspectives that happen? What's the connection between the two? What kind of comfort, or is he just... is he not accepting that his 127-year-old mom died? Was he like stuck on the trauma of the period of the last sentence of her life? Is that what's going on with him? He has a grieving problem. It says he loves Rivka, and then he was comforted after his mother. What's the connection?
He just needed some help to get through the grieving process to like get him over.
Rivka able to give him the hug of the grieving counselor that nobody else was able to accomplish? Is that what's going on? Or was it really that there was a intrinsic dynamic in the relationship of the relationship between Yitzchak and Rivka per se?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
Why was he now coming? What was holding back his? What was he sad about? What was he continuing to be sad about the loss of his mom until Rivka showed up in his life?
He was lonely.
I think it was more than that.
He says more the spiritual lacking of the matriarch or the generation, and now it's like he's without that, and now he sees he married the right person, and that spirituality is back on.
Exactly. In other words, the Abrahamic community was, even that Avram's great, but Avram is half the show. Without Sarah, it doesn't work. You know what I'm saying? There's a husband and wife team. If the team is not present, there was a sadness. It's not that he couldn't accept that his 127-year-old mom's dead. I mean, you know, life's not forever. It's just that he was sad. He missed Sarah, not simply, of course he was sad about his mom, but he missed her as the important role that she played, that her as Chaim said so nicely, the loss of the spiritual impact of Sarah was devastating. But that's what but now that he has Rivka back, he loves her, he appreciates her Ezer Kenegdo-ness, how such a great person she is, a person of you know, let's use the famous phrase from the Aishas Chayil, a woman of valor. He feels great because now there's somebody to take her to fill that role. He's feeling more spiritually complete because he feels that the community now has what it needs. He has what he needs, and they have what they need for her to have a complete experience of the Abrahamic tradition. Okay, I want to finish up with a couple of scenarios. Scenario number one, Josh has just returned from an inspiring summer of learning in Israel. Thinking about the story of Yitzchak, he wonders whether he needs to spend much time dating before marriage. After all, Yitzchak never went on a date and came to love Rivka after marriage. Is this a wise application of the example of Yitzchak and Rivka? What do you guys say? Yitzchak did not go on a date. Oh, so why am I spending so much time on dates? You know, just go on a couple and then you're done. Is that a wise application of our story of this week's Parsha?
Well, they may not have gone on a date. You do have Eliezer, who you could say vetted Rivka.
Yes, he did.
And found her not lacking, found that she would be a good fit, that she had the midot of a woman who would be a good partner to Yitzchak, as well as a good person to continue on what Sarah had started.
So he basically did the dating for him.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So therefore, what would you say to Josh? What would you tell him?
He needs to date, but to date with a purpose. So not just go out and have a good time, but to have those conversations or do those activities that will show him the midot of the person that he's on the date with.
Right. That would be the appropriate takeaway, not by the quantity of dates or non-dates that Yitzchak and Rivka went on. Right. You'd say that basically that they were marriage minded. Obviously they had, he had the benefit of Eliezer doing the, shall we say, the vetting, and was a very rare experience. And also Yitzchak is a very special person. You know what I mean? He's the you know, what's good for him is not nothing good for us. But I think your application is a good one, that, you know, you're dating for a purpose. You're looking for your Ezer Kenegdo. You're looking for your Eishas Chayil. You're looking for the male equivalent of that, of the Eish Chayil and the Ezer Kenegdo on the male side, both sides. Excellent. Good. Thank you, Shayna. Question number two. Dan has just lost his grandfather. Chaim is completely broken up by the experience. He has a challenging time delivering a eulogy for his grandfather. What ideas could be learned from Avram's example of eulogizing his beloved Sarah? What should he do? He's completely broken up. He had a very close relationship with a grandfather. What should he do to go ahead to prepare and to present a great eulogy? How do you do that? What should he do? What suggestions can you give Dan? You guys got nothing.
Speak from the heart.
Okay, speaking from the heart is always important. Yes, we talked about that. What else? But we said it's not just speaking from the heart. Giving some, there's some specific goals and guidelines, not just any speaking from the heart.
He needs to speak in a way that he can transmit to the people attending the funeral just how much his grandfather meant to the world.
Yeah. And so what? So what? Should, So what's the first thing he has to do, really? In order to do that, accomplish that goal, what's the first thing he must do?
He has to reflect on who his grandfather was, what he did in his life. How did he touch others?
Exactly. What you need to do, and by the way, guys, this is a very important skill. You're going to be called upon to share a meaningful, moving eulogy for a loved one. Maybe you've done this already, but you will have to do this. Most people don't do a good job because they don't know what they don't know what a eulogy really is. So I'm going to tell you what the essence is. As Eitan says, you need to sit there and you need to distill what was the greatness, what was the impact, what was the great virtues that, you know, in this case, the grandfather affected you and others. Figure it out what those, one way to do it is what adjectives best describe his personality? One or two or three adjectives, and use that as a way to try to find out his essence. You're going to try to find the soul of the person, describe it, and then bring out those stories that best illustrate it and talk about how great that those value, that virtues are. You might bring, a statement from the Torah, Pasuk, Mishnah, Pirkeiavos, whatever it is to anchor it. And that's how you give a good eulogy. You distill the essence of the quality of the person, bring those stories that provide clarity, examples, and you make it moving. And to the extent that people will cry because they feel the loss. They feel the loss. Okay, last one. Jonathan.
No, I was always going to, my best memory is my mother going to Broadway shows, but that's another story.
Right, but that's sharing that I love my mom. She was a lover.
The ones I share a lot with people that knew her, because a lot of people that I knew her, like, knew we always went to Broadway shows together, especially. So that was our thing.
But is the essence of her greatness that she attended Broadway shows, or that she was a loving mother that cared for her son and wanted to make sure that you guys had special experiences together that you would always remember her?
Yes, the happiness of seeing me smile every time I went to a Broadway show, right, whether it was a good one or a bad one. Reviews were not good. It was just the moment of being there. Yes.
Right. Because it was important to her to invest both time and money to ensure that her son had a cultural experience as a way for them to have a fun time, but also to be together in a loving way. So really it's not about the Broadway show. It's about the Broadway show reflects that her mandate was, I want to be a good mom. I want to be a loving mom. And I want to spend very special moments with my children. Would you say that's an accurate reflection?
Yes.
But you know what I'm pointing out there? In other words, the Broadway show was the way that she showed her love. And the way that she created a loving moment. It wasn't the Broadway. Nor to say, she liked Broadway shows. That's not really, she liked Broadway shows. But that's not her greatness. Her greatness was that she would go to Broadway shows as a way to bring her children closer to her. You know what I'm saying? It's a distinction. I want to make sure you guys do appreciate that, because it's a good example, Jonathan. Thank you for sharing. This is a life skill that is very important to have. So I want, that's one takeaway from the Parsha. Last scenario before we call it a night. Scenario three, Stacy has been married to Jonathan for 3 years. She has noticed that she and Jonathan have begun to fight about whose turn it is to wash the dishes. Jonathan is a very successful businessman, claims that he needs to do more work after dinner. Stacy, an administrator for a local yeshiva, feels insulted. You think I have nothing to do after a long day of caring for the kids? How can the concept of Acer Connecto, illustrated in Tom Brady and Giselle's marriage, be helpful in dealing with their issues? How would you help this couple? Eitan, you're a married man for a bunch of years. How many years have you been married, Eitan?
You were dancing at my wedding.
I was. I know, but I don't remember exactly how many years ago that was.
That was 2014. It's 8 years now.
Aruch Hashem. So, what would you say to Jonathan and Stacy in this scenario?
I would say to them that they need to sit down and talk about really what's their values. What are they both working towards? They need to. They came together, with a purpose, and they have kids together, hopefully all towards that purpose, and they need to maybe reconnect on that so that they can find that ground. And I think in doing that, Jonathan would probably be much happier to say, you know what, the right thing is for me to do some more dishes. The work can wait.
Right. Right. By reinforcing, by each person validating each person's contribution to the marriage and to the and to the goal of the household, they could be able to navigate how to deal with the various natural chores in the marriage. Or Jonathan's initial move is to be a little bit, hey, I'm making the money. I don't want to do the dishes. You do the dishes. But she says, hey, I'm also making the money, and I also will take care of the kids, and I need some help here. So they got to work that out. They got to be working together as a team here, and they got to go back to their common values. What brought you together? What is real? Why are you guys creating the home that you are? Eitan, so thank you so much for that. So that's a very important point. So look, I think we had we brought in Tom Brady. Giselle. We're not saying these are bad people. They're people trying, like many. It's funny. In certain sense, they're not regular people because they're both, celebrities, but their marriage ended for problems that are not so uncommon to other families. They just did it, unfortunately, in front of, a billion people. So that's the problem. But we're able to use them as a nice way to compare and contrast the beautiful relationship of Abram and Sarah. How Abram related to Sarah. Sarah means, Sarai, my princess. Sarah, sort of the princess, the majestic princess. And how they worked together. Sometimes, he asked her to, he pointed out things that she had to work on. She accepted it. And sometimes she pointed out things that he has to work on and he accepted. They had a really mutually respectful and understanding, and they were working together to a goal which was beyond themselves, and therefore they had a tremendous success. And they know they had a personal life and they had a public life, and their public life, Avram did not, focus on his personal relationship. He wanted to share the eulogy first before he goes into the tent to cry. So that was Avram and Sarah are an amazing family, but there's what we can learn from them in our own relationships, and also specifically the idea of a eulogy, which is a little bit sad, but we could do that with excellence. And then conversely, concluding with the great relationship of Yitzchak and Rivka, who Yitzchak found comfort because Rivka became basically the as did Sarah, and took on the same mantle of responsibility. And that caused her, since that made him basically be her soulmate, because he loved her not just for her beautiful, because I'll say she was also very beautiful. You see that next week, Parsha. But she was a person of great character and depth and personal and internal beauty. And that's why he loved her. And also he was comforted because now as Chaim pointed out, the spiritual loss of Sarah was taken care of by the fact that that Rivka now had tamed the scene. All right, everybody. I want to thank you so much. Have a lovely night. Any questions?
Rabbi, 2 years ago when Rabbi Sachs passed away around this time of year, you did... your parsha shir was on writing a eulogy, and you gave Prince Charles as an example of a good eulogy. Another one that's an example of a good eulogy is if you it was published on the Rabbi Sacks website this year, 2022, for the Parsha, I think it's Ha'azinu or Vizor HaBracha, when Moshe dies. Rabbi Sacks wrote basically a eulogy for Moshe Rabbeinu that...
Oh, wow.
I was crying learning it with my chavruta, and my chavruta was like, but it's Moshe Rabbeinu. He's not someone we know in person. Why are you crying? And right. it was so beautiful.
Wow. You got me curious. I got to check that out. That's a powerful huge because he's been dead for 3,500 years.
Can you share that? Yeah.
So just share that link there, Shane, if you can.
Bear with me. Let me see if I can find it.
Rabbi, I want to tell